Good evening. You know, I've always been a lot more comfortable coming up and doing this than I ever have been with, doing the song leading, and I'm still terrified. So you know how I feel when I do some song leading, man. So this lesson, I called it, How Do I Pay Jesus Back? This lesson's based around a Lord's Supper talk that I gave a few months back. And the way that the topic came up was from speaking with a young man in Porterville. We were having a conversation out there, and as we were kind of going back and forth, this is how the conversation went with the young man. He said, "Kevin, I never feel like I'm doing enough for Jesus." And this is something that started a train of thought for me. Because the idea, as the conversation went on, that he was conveying is that he wanted to be able to say that at the end of his life, by the time all that is through, he wants to be able to say, "I finally did it. I finally paid back God for sending his son on the cross for me. I finally paid off my debt for sin." So today I kind of want to look into this question that he had, or this desire to repay my sin in full. In order to start doing this, we need to start looking at Jesus. And so we're going to start in Isaiah chapter 9, 6 through 7. And Isaiah chapter 9 is, we're going to see Jesus being prophesied as coming. So again, it's Isaiah chapter 9, 6 through 7. And it reads here, "For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. There will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this." So here it is, we see something coming forth of Jesus being foretold of coming hundreds of years before he ever actually came to earth. And it was said that he's going to be from the lineage of David. David, who we heard about this morning, is somebody who was able to hold on to his rock. Somebody that we can look up to. Somebody that we know also had some trouble with sin as well. Something I talked about in my first lesson was something that happened with him and David and Bathsheba. You know, he fell short of the glory of God. He committed sin. Same thing with Moses. You know, Moses was a very well-respected figure. In fact, probably one of the most well-known prophets in the entire world is Moses. And so when you look at that, you also can find out by looking at him that he as well sinned and fell short of the glory of God. Same with the kings of Israel. Israel, God's chosen nation. And we know they had a lot of sins, a great many ways in which they fell short. So you may be wondering to yourself, you know, why did I go about speaking about Jesus the way that I had started and then just immediately go into the sinful nature of man? Well, that's because in order for us to truly understand what it is that Jesus and his death on the cross means for us, we need to understand what it is that the people of the Old Testament had to do in order to seek forgiveness for their sins. So in order to start doing that, we're going to take a look at Leviticus, and we're going to actually look at some of the sacrifices that they needed to do in order to receive atonement for sins. Not even full forgiveness, they received atonement for their sins. So Leviticus chapter 4, 1 through 5, and it reads, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, If any person sins unintentionally in any of the things which the Lord has commanded not to be done, and commits any of them, if the anointed priest sins so as to bring guilt on the people, then let him offer to the Lord a bull without defect, as a sin offering for the sin he has committed. He shall bring the bull to the doorway of the tent of meeting before the Lord. And he shall lay his head on the head of the bull, hand on the head of the bull, and slay the bull before the Lord. Then the anointed priest is to take some of the blood of the bull and bring it to the tent of meeting." So here we can actually see a brief look at some of the sacrifices being taken place here for sins as well, that the people didn't realize that they had committed. And when it comes down to this is actually something that Randy had taken a look at. He looked through these chapters in Leviticus and these verses that I'm going to peer through here And he went into a little more information. So, I mean, you can always look back if you want more information on this type of stuff. You know, Randy gave a really good lesson on it a couple months back. I'm just, you know, he inspired me when I started thinking on this lesson and thought I would bring some of these back up as well. So then the next verses I want to take a look in for these for this look into sacrifice is verses 13 through 14. Now, if the whole congregation of Israel commits error and the matter escapes the notice of the assembly, and they commit any of the things which the Lord has commanded not to be done, and they become guilty, when the sin which they have committed becomes known, then the assembly shall offer a bull of the herd for a sin offering and bring it before the tent of meeting. So now we're speaking of an offering for the entire congregation in which sin has come forth. So now you add that into the different types of things they got to keep track of when they're looking through the different ways in which they have to approach sin. Moving forward, Leviticus 5, 1 through 5, and it reads, "Now if a person sins after he hears a public adjuration to testify when he is a witness, whether he has seen or otherwise known, if he does not tell it, then he will bear his guilt. Or if a person touches any unclean thing, whether a carcass of an unclean beast or the carcass of an unclean cattle or a carcass of unclean swarming things, though it is hidden from him and he is unclean, then he will be guilty. Or if he touches human uncleanness, of whatever sort his uncleanness may be with which he becomes unclean, and it is hidden from him, and then he comes to know it, he will be guilty. Or if a person swears thoughtlessly with his lips to do evil or to do good, in whatever manner a man may speak thoughtlessly with an oath, and it is hidden from him, and then he comes to know it, he will be guilty in one of these. So it shall be, when he becomes guilty in one of these, that he shall confess that in which he has sinned." So here it is, when it's a sin for somebody touching something that was unclean and they were unaware of it. Yet again, they have an offering for that, a type of way in which you have to go about seeking atonement for this sin. Or even if you took an oath that you were unable to keep for good or bad reasons or whatever it is, and you weren't able to fulfill it. And now you've become guilty. Moving forward, we also have Leviticus 5, verses 5 through 7. It has even further on some of the contingencies in which that has been accounted for here. "So it shall be, when he becomes guilty in one of these, that he shall confess that in which he has sinned. He shall also bring his guilt offering to the Lord for his sin which he has committed, a female from the flock, a lamb or a goat as a sin offering. So the priest shall make atonement on his behalf for his sin. But if he cannot afford a lamb, then he shall bring to the Lord his guilt offering for that in which he has sinned, two turtle doves or two young pigeons, one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering." So here we have, like I said, we have another contingency, in which case someone is not able to afford the lamb or goat in which they're told to bring forth. Now they can take forth either two turtle doves or two young pigeons. Man, that's a lot to keep track of. And it goes on and on within the verses in through Leviticus. You can find more and more about the different things in which needed to be done for the different sins and different sacrifices that need to take place. So there's a lot of stuff in here to keep track of, a lot of language being used, and some of the language is not for the faint of heart. In fact, Leviticus 17 and 11 starts to kind of tell us why. It gives us some insight as to why they used blood the way that they did for the in this ceremonial fashion. "For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you on the altar to make atonement for your souls. For it is the blood by reason of the life that makes atonement." So it says it right at the beginning there. For the life of the flesh is in the blood. And so that's why it is that they know, or that they do all these different sacrifices involving the blood. Something that Chris Pruitt told me a long time ago. And it was something that really blew my mind when I had first come back, before I got back to Bakersfield here. He brought me this verse here and said, showed it as an evidence for God. This is information that life is in the blood, that you actually didn't realize on like a scientific level back at this time. They used to actually drain people of their blood, trying to get rid of whatever toxin was inside of people, going in, not realizing that life is in the blood. And it's right here in Leviticus. All that we're reading here about sacrifice is what we would have to be doing today had it not been for Jesus and his death on the cross as our sacrificial lamb. Jesus died once on our behalf and not over and over again on an altar. And this is, like I said, only just scratching the surface of all the different types of sacrifices and things that went on in the Old Testament in reference towards sin. But Jesus didn't just die for us, however. He endured for us. Look with me at John chapter 19, verses 1 through 6. Here we see Jesus getting ready for going up on the cross. You know, everything, the preparation is all being set into place. Now, verse 19, verse 1, it reads, Pilate then took Jesus and scourged him. And the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head. And put a purple robe on him. And they began to come up to him and say, Hail, King of the Jews. And to give him slaps in the face. Pilate came out again and said to them, Behold, I am bringing him out to you so that you may know that I find no guilt in him. Jesus then came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. Pilate said to them, Behold the man. So when the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, saying, Crucify, crucify. Pilate said to him, Take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him. So here it is. Jesus is being dressed up like royalty as a type of joke because he was being put into purple robes, and purple was a color that was used for royalty. And so it was done in the form of mockery here. So like I said, he endured for us. He endured this type of humiliation. As well, they twisted together a crown of thorns. And, you know, I'd always seen those pictures. They have different paintings and stuff where you see the crown of thorn on Jesus' head and you see the blood running down. And, you know, I got so blinded by seeing that over and over again. I never actually sat down to think about the act of putting a crown of thorns on his head. My mom has some lemon trees in the backyard, and when I go out to pick those things, I wear gloves, gardening gloves, because those things have thorns, and they hurt, man. I've been poked by those suckers, and they, even with the gardening gloves, they can still pierce their way through into my finger. And here it is, they're twisting this into a crown of thorns and placing it onto Jesus' head. And I can only imagine, I mean, that hurts on my hand. It's a calloused part of my body. Your head, that's like one of the places with the least amount of skin. And this is, like I said, just this is part of what it was that Jesus had to endure on our behalf, because this was part of his dressing him up as a king to be able to humiliate him. And then the next thing that comes out is Pilate takes Jesus out in front of the people, in front of the Jews, in front of Jesus' people who he came on their behalf to die for them. I mean, he did it for all mankind, but, you know, Jesus was King of the Jews, right? And here he is presented in front of them, Pilate saying, I find nothing wrong with him. And they start yelling, crucify, crucify. I can only imagine the type of feeling in which that would actually cause whenever that would take place. Because he came down on their behalf. This is the king that they'd been waiting for. And they're throwing him away. They don't want anything to do with him. So they put him on the cross and crucifying, like I said, I could imagine would be a really painful experience. So the whole process of crucifixion, putting him there on the cross, you know, involved a lot of torment and trials. They humiliated him, had a lot of physical pain, but he also had to endure a lot of emotional pain as well. Now, getting back to the comment or that conversation from the young man that I spoke about earlier, and he's actually a couple years older than me, but everyone looks at me as a young man still, so I feel like it's fitting to call him the young man. As far as it goes, with our conversation, wanting to pay off the debt that he owes to Jesus, the debt of sin that he has. So in that conversation that we had, he asks me, how can I do enough to pay Jesus back? What do I do? Because I don't feel like I'm doing enough. How do I pay back somebody who did so much for me so selflessly? It's an interesting question that he posed to me. And the answer is that you can't. There's nothing that you're going to be able to do in order to pay Jesus back, to pay it in full for the sins that you've committed, for his death on the cross on your behalf. So, once you start to think there's nothing I can do, that can actually take you down a train of thought, if you want to try and run this down a worldly, logical standpoint. And so, it can be a train of thought that can cause a great deal of trouble. The idea of, if I can't ever pay Jesus back, then what's the point? It's a scary place for a Christian to be. Because if you look at this from the earthly point of view, then the idea is, I owe a debt. One that I will always own. And so, if you're to say, owe an entity, maybe, you know, like the Department of Education, say you owe them $1 million. And you know, in my lifetime, I'm not going to make $1 million. And you sit there and you say, how am I going to pay this back? And you start, you know, worrying about that. At this point, your credit score is already shot. As far as everything that they're going to do to you, let's say in this situation, it's done. It has now happened, and here they're asking you for your money. What you can do is you can sit back and pay them back little by little, never getting out from under the debt. Or you can just say, you know what? It's done. I'm already labeled a debtor. May as well just spend what little money I make on myself. I don't make that much money anyways. May as well, you know, do what I want to do. So that's kind of a current world way that you can kind of relate this over. So let's take it down. This kind of train of thought to a spiritual discussion. We can look at, you know, say the credit score as your sin, that you are the sin of the debtor and that you're not able to pay it back. And you think to yourself, may as well live my life how I want to because I must be going to hell anyways. And with that kind of train of thought, I don't know if you've ever noticed, there's actually like t-shirts and stickers and other kind of things like that that you can stick a logo on. And it says that I'm going to hell anyways, may as well have fun on the way there. Let's party it up. That's kind of the idea in which they're trying to sell with that. You know, that it's futile. That this plays straight into this futility mindset that I was going about earlier. The debt's too great. My sin's too awful. What's the point of trying? Well, if you'll look with me at Matthew chapter 25, and we'll take a look at a parable here. Maybe this can give us a little more insight in why it is that it's not completely futile, or at least the problem with giving no effort at all. So Matthew 25, 14 through 15, and it reads, "For it is just like a man about to go on a journey who called his own slaves and entrusted his possessions to them. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, each according to his own ability, and he went on his journey." We're going to move forward now to 24 through 29. And right before this, the servant who received his 5 talents doubled it into 10. The servant with 2 talents doubled it into 4. And the servant who had 1 talent, well, he was afraid because of what he had before him, the immense task that he felt like he was put under, and he just hid that 1 talent away. And so this is where we pick up. "And the one also who had received the 1 talent came up and said, 'Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. And I was afraid and went away and hid your talent in the ground. See, you have what is yours.' But his master answered and said to him, 'You wicked, lazy slave, you knew that I reap where I do not sow and gather where I scattered no seed. Then you ought to have put my money in the bank, and on my arrival, I would have received my money back with interest. Therefore, take away the talent from him and give it to the one who has the 10 talents. For to everyone who has, more shall be given, and he will have an abundance. But for the one who does not have, even what he does have shall be taken away.'" So here, the master was angered because the one slave saw what he thought was futile. And he decided to do nothing with the talent. He was given a gift and he didn't use it. Yet the other servants went out and they doubled what they received. He was there and he said, you know what, I'm not going to lose this talent. I don't want to do that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just sit back and do nothing with it, where he could have actually done what he could to try to double his talents. So what's the point of working for Jesus? How does this fully translate over to what it is I'm talking about? If you do so, you will be able to grow in abundance when it comes to working for Jesus. If you work for Jesus, you'll be able to grow in abundance. If you work for him, your continence will grow. If, however, you do not, all you have will be taken away from you, and you will be sent to the dark place where there is gnashing of teeth. Therefore, the same is meant for us as it is in the case with the parable. If we want to try to do right by Jesus, we are to work for him. And to do this, or to do his will. But if we don't, then we are to doom ourselves to a place where there is gnashing of teeth. And I don't know about you, but I don't want to go to a place described as with gnashing of teeth. So going back yet again to that conversation that I had with that young man, and I told him that Jesus knew that we're not going to ever be able to pay back the debt to him, that we'd never be able to repay him. And he knew that our relationship was going to be one-sided. Yet he entered into a relationship with us nonetheless. And that's the glory and the mercy of God, that he would send us his only begotten Son, unworthy though we were to receive him. I also told him that just because we can't pay back Jesus doesn't mean that we shouldn't try. Now, of course, I don't mean to be confusing and try and give the idea that we are going to be able, if we work really, really hard, to pay off our sin in full. That's not the idea. The idea that I'm trying to convey, we need to work for Jesus and do his will so valiantly to the point where we're trying to do so. So at the end, when we're on our deathbed, we're not sitting there saying, I finally paid back Jesus for my debt. But we can say at least, you know, I tried my hardest. I was the best person I can be. And I really hope that Jesus is proud of me. That's the goal that we have laying on our deathbed there, rather than laying over and saying, I did it, I'm paid in full, but I tried and I gave it my all. That's the mindset that we need to approach here. Approach as if we were able to earn his mercy and grace, knowing that those things are not something that we can earn. Moving back into like a real world example that may be able to kind of help you understand that as well, would be like with that of a pro football player. Imagine you have a pro football player who is realizing that he's not going to end up in a Hall of Fame, or that he's not going to hold some type of world record. You know, I'm not going to have the most touchdown passes in a single game. And therefore, it's pointless. I'm going to quit playing football, you know. I don't want to do this anymore, just because I'm not going to hold that record. Well, of course we don't see a pro football player doing that, because he has his reason for playing the game. For him, it's, you know, millions and millions of dollars through paychecks and stuff. But when it comes to us as Christians, what it is that our goal is that we should be trying to do is to try to work for Jesus. Is that as Christians, it should become that we get become justified through Christ. That should be our goal. You know, when it comes to being justified through Christ, Chris Pruitt had actually worded it really well and always stuck with me. But something that he said is, when you're trying to be justified through Christ, imagine it this way: justified, never sinned. And that's the goal in which we're trying to move forward for. It should be something that we want to do to embrace that talent that we receive, excuse me, which is the forgiveness that we receive and the promise of heaven if we are willing to receive it. So that starts to bring us into the idea of what it is that I am to do. Well, we know that we are told to partake of the Lord's Supper, something that we just did not too long ago. We're supposed to be doing that every week, and when we do so, we have the bread, which represents the body of Christ, which was beaten and pierced for my behalf. And we have the fruit of the vine, which represents the blood. And as we talked about before with Leviticus chapter 17, you know, that life is in the blood and is used for atonement for sin. And so when Jesus had died on the cross, his blood was spilt in reference or to be able to fulfill that of the Old Testament sacrifice to be able to be the eternal sacrifice for our behalf. So we have that we do take up every single week. And it's a symbolic thing that actually benefits us more than anything else as a reminder to us of what it is that Jesus had done for us. Another thing that I want to take a look at is 1 Corinthians verse 12:12-17. And we've actually been having a class Sunday morning held by Rick that was going over Corinthians here. So this is something we actually talked about not too long ago. So starting in Corinthians 12, starting verse 12, it reads, "For even as the body is one and yet has many members, and all the members of the body, though they are many, are one body, so also is Christ. For by one Spirit we were all baptized into one body, whether Jews or Greeks, whether slaves or free, and we were all made to drink of one Spirit. For the body is not one member but many. If the foot says, 'Because I am not a hand, I am not a part of the body,' it is not for this reason any the less a part of the body. And if the ear says, 'Because I am not an eye, I am not a part of the body,' it is not for this reason any less part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would the hearing be? If the whole body were hearing, where would the sense of smell be?" So here it talks about unique responsibilities within the body of Christ. That everybody cannot do the same thing, because if they did, then other areas would go neglected. Some of the duties are very easily seen and some are not. But that doesn't make them any less useful. When this letter was originally being written, it was in reference to gifts that had been given to the members at the church of Corinth. The different types of like healing, they were able to speak in tongues and decipher tongues. And they had all these different things in which they were able to do. And some of them were feeling like their gift was worthless compared to other ones, worth less than other ones. And they started becoming jealous and wanting to have some of the greater gifts. So Paul wrote the letter to the church to let them know, among many other things, that each gift had its own purpose. And I ask, then what was the reason that these members received these gifts? And it's to be able to serve as evidence to the rest of the world, as well as to edify each other and the world. So going back to us, and how can we look at this verse and how can we use it? Well, these same goals without those gifts mentioned are still applicable for us as well. We each have our own individual gifts. Whether it's, you know, giving a lesson, teaching a class, singing songs, writing letters to those who missed a service, or visiting the sick. It all has its purpose, as long as we are teaching the Word of God and edifying one another. As I've said before, we are to be an example to the world. That was something I talked about last time that I was up here. And so we are intended to be examples. And so if that's what we are doing, then we are doing the Lord's will. To further this idea, let's look at Ephesians chapter 4, verse 11. "And he gave some as apostles, and some as prophets, and some evangelists, and some as pastors and teachers." So we all have our own duties as children of God, in which we are to help to edify one another and bring each other up. Something else that we need to think about when it comes to trying to repay our debt to Christ is that this is not a worldly debt. It's a spiritual one, meaning that it came from above. Jesus, the thing about that that makes that so special is that Jesus doesn't need anything from us. God doesn't need anything from us. There's nothing that we can give him that he doesn't already have. Our duty to Christ is truly for our own benefit. Everything that we do here as a congregation is not to serve as some type of, you know, ego stroke for God or anything like that. When we praise Him, we don't do it because that's what God needs from us, but because that is what God knows that we need as His people. And it comes to benefit us, as I said before, with the Lord's Supper, and that is the type of thing that it comes to our benefit more than anything else. We need to go through these types of things because as people, we're very forgetful. And if we don't continue through this, then we're going to forget 5 minutes later and end up going back out into sin. We as men sin even after being saved by Jesus. Yet we don't have to sacrifice. Instead, we have the ability to come to God for forgiveness. Now, a while back, Dan Stitt was actually teaching a Wednesday class on types and antitypes. And this brought me to a conclusion that I find to be very interesting and enlightening. You know, it's something that blew my mind when he was first discussing it. And it comes from the comparison of Israel and their trek out of Egypt and baptism and some of the similarities there as a type and antitype. Israel, when they were going from Egypt into the land of milk and honey, the promised land, they're on their way through. They saw the Red Sea part. They saw manna come from the sky. They saw water come from a rock, the pillar of fire by night and the pillar of cloud by day to lead them on. And they saw all these different acts that there's no other reason that this could happen other than it's a miracle from God. They saw evidence of God. And as they come through and they move on and things start to get tough, they say, we were better off in Egypt. We had it better in Egypt than we do now. God's obviously toying with us. You know, some doubt in which that they started to feel. And, you know, it's kind of a interesting idea when you start to think about it. It's like, how can these people be grumbling like this? How can they think that they had it better off in Egypt? Now let's bring the comparison over to baptism. When we get baptized, we start to see the effects of Jesus and God in our life. And we start to see these changes that we start to make and that are made through us. And as we go through, every once in a while, we'll start to take a look back at a sin and say, you know, that looks really appealing. Man, that looks really good. I want to do that. And so sometimes we ourselves are, in a sense, grumbling in the same way that they were there. You know, and like I said earlier, it's so easy to say, how is it those people could have done that? But then you think to yourself, what if I was in that situation? You know, we've all heard the term, what would Jesus do? WWJD. I want to ask you, what would I do? What would Kevin do? WWKD. If I was in that situation and in the same setup, would I have acted the way that Israel did or not? Without being there, it's a really hard question to ask, but you look at how you look towards sin and you can start to see how maybe it isn't as easy as I had originally thought it could have been. So I want to look another comparison as well that was made was Israel having to walk a hard path to get to the promised land. They had to go through all kinds of different strafes in order to make it all the way there. And then at the home stretch, they end up bowing out. They're scared because of the big stature of the other nations. And they say, you know, we can't do this. And they back down. And it's not till the next generation that comes by that they actually end up entering into the promised land. The same thing with us. We have to walk a narrow road to get to heaven, to get to our promised land. It's filled with all kinds of different strife as well. And the thing is we're not once saved, always saved. No, in fact, as far as it goes, we can live our life with Jesus and then fall away and fall short. And if we don't go back, if we don't look for forgiveness, then we too will miss out of our promised land at the home stretch there. So if you'd look with me, the next thing I want to look at comes James chapter 2, 14 through 18. And here we're told that faith without works is dead. So again, James 2, starting in verse 14, it reads, What use is it, my brethren, if someone says he has faith, but he has no works? Can that faith save him? If a brother or sister is without clothing and in need of daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warmed and be filled, and yet you do not give them what is necessary for their body, what use is that? Even so, faith, if it has no works, is dead, being by itself. But someone may well say, you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith without the works, and I will show you my faith by my works. I started my lesson today talking about a conversation, asking about how to pay back God, and that we never could do it. Yet there's a point to be made about trying. I may not be able to pay back Jesus, but I can work as though I'm trying to earn the grace and mercy that he gives us. Because that's all we need to be doing, is doing the Lord's will to be able to earn, or I guess earn is the wrong word, but to receive our spot in heaven. So when it comes down to it, if you yourself have not taken up an opportunity to be able to receive the forgiveness that the Lord offers, to be able to take advantage of some of these talents, these gifts that I've spent some time talking about today, or maybe you think to yourself that I'm not doing enough and I need some more help coming along and moving forward, then, you know, you need to let other people know. Or, yet again, if you think to yourself, I've got it, I've done it, I've paid back Jesus, and I'm good to go, I'm just cruising through now until the end of days, waiting for that because I'm good to go, then maybe you should take some time to relook through the Bible, see if there's something you missed, because there probably is. But if this invitation in any way does apply for you, then please let us know as together we all stand and sing.